It's time for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 3 years has shared with us her decades research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative and judicial processes in America. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon. This is Dialogue Conspiracy number 183, February the 10th, Monday afternoon in Carmel, California. I'm going to mention the class at MPC that I'll be giving hopefully this next week and a half. It'll begin and then we'll go into a discussion for the remaining 45 minutes about the conference in Boston called The Politics of Conspiracy that took place last week, and I want to talk at length about that and the various researchers that were there. Last spring, I gave a course in humanities, Monterey Peninsula College, with Ray Fabrizio and Mr. Yamato, which was a very successful course, I felt, in terms of student response. There were older people there, young people, some from the military, and we had 94 taking it for credit. There were another 100 at least visiting every week in lecture form 102. The energy that was given off was tremendous. The enthusiasm was great. And we gave out reading lists every week and felt that people could begin to study the news and analyze various conspiracies that have been taking place or took place in the past. It was a very detailed class, 16 weeks, 2 hours a week. There was no course in the fall, and I was told that we could have this class in the spring. By the time the class was set up, there was a subject of changing the title from conspiracies and assassinations to something having to do with Robert Kennedy and John Kennedy. There was another meeting of Mr. Fabrizio with the faculty. The political science department wouldn't have the course under their heading. The history department wouldn't have it under their heading. The humanities department didn't want it under their heading. They couldn't figure out where it fit. The English department finally put it in as English 195. The class was not listed in the catalog. People came over from Salinas and were told the class was full when there were no names on the list at all. The school newspaper had nothing about it this year, and people who called in were told that they didn't know anything about it from the switchboard or any department. I never got any date about when the course was to start. I announced on the radio that it would be given because I was told that it would be given. I met somebody the other day from the courthouse who said, oh, your class starts tomorrow, and I didn't know it. I called a member of the faculty to see if I should come over, and he said, no, don't bother to come over. It will take 2 hours to enroll them the first day. And I didn't believe there were that many students. Not only did I not know the day it was to begin, but I was told it wouldn't be necessary to come to the first session, which was pretty outrageous because last year, the faculty wanted to enroll, and the students were so anxious to begin learning facts and information that we went right into the course the very first day. And I didn't intend to go over to the college yesterday until I received a phone call from somebody at Hartnell College who had come over on Friday to enroll and was told the class was filled. So this was obvious to me that the course was supposed to die, and the students signing up for classes, English, humanities, history, political science, were not to know it wasn't to be given because, as I say, it wasn't in the bulletin, it wasn't on the schedules, and I wasn't told when it was to be given, and I was told not to come. A few people, I went over there when I found out what was happening, realized, and a few people were there, and the subject came up, should we put in the school newspaper if the bulletin couldn't print it in, or in the newspaper, the Monterey Herald. And we were told if we weren't there by Friday, 2 days later, then the course would be dropped. Then I was told that the reason it wasn't into any bulletin or school catalog when students signed up was because I talked about the program on the radio. Now you can figure out if it's not in any bulletin and it's not listed in any catalog or in the newspaper or the student newspaper and you can't talk about it on the air, then the course is meant to die because the teacher giving it with me already had another class assigned for him on a full case load if this enrollment didn't equal the other one, which meant through this bureaucracy it would be shelved. I hate to see these students not have an opportunity to learn another side of history. I know this is a military town. We have Fort Ord, the Navy Postgraduate School, the Spy School, the Language School, and the Telecommunication System out at Peshawar. But even then, with 200 people attending last year and the enthusiasm it generated, the taxpayer should have a right to hear a researcher who's done 11 years of work, along with a teacher who's done a lot of work into political conspiracies. We should have the right to show them the documentation, the volumes to read, to come to their conclusions as to whether or not the government commission was telling the truth about political assassinations. So next Wednesday, we got an extension on the course for people who would like to attend and go right to the English department. And then we were told you have to have the papers in by Wednesday, and the faculty sign the paper. But Wednesday is Lincoln's birthday, and that again prolongs it. So I understand that if you have an interest in the course, you have until a week from Wednesday, and it'll be in lecture form 101 from 2 to 4 on Wednesdays if you are interested in seeing this course again. I personally would like to give the course. I don't get that much out of it except the direct communication with young people in my own local community, which is what the establishment or the powers that be feel threatened about. I know a lot of classes on campus were influenced by this particular course and asked questions of their professors on how certain conclusions were reached or certain questions about the government. And there are many people over there that don't like these kinds of questions asked. We had one visitor from the faculty psychology professor who visited the class last year for 1 hour and just about told everyone in the class that they were mentally deranged for not being home throwing frisbees that day, that it was a nice day. And what he said in effect was that it was really a mental sickness to want to know what was going to happen, and that these conspiracies, if they were, are going to move on anyway, and that you shouldn't busy yourself with it. But it's easy for that man to say that because he's a citizen from Switzerland, as I understand. He is not an American citizen. I wonder about the relationship of various spy agencies to Switzerland that I've studied, and I think that a non-American citizen has no right to tell us that we can't study our American electoral process. And if this offends the powers that be over at MPC, we don't need the class at all. I conducted a class in my home last fall. As a matter of fact, I had 8 people and charged them $30 each. We had 5 sessions where we talked about the nature of conspiracies, the way they come down, who's behind them. And I would just as soon teach small classes if the faculty there deprives the young people here of having the class. The message will go out, and it doesn't matter how much they sit on it, the truth is going to come out in this country. And that leads to the next subject, the politics of conspiracy, the conference that took place in Boston, Massachusetts, January 31st, February 1st and 2nd. There were 3 days of meetings of various researchers into political assassinations and conspiracies. About 1,000 people attended from Boston University, and from some came in from New York, some from Ohio. Various states converged in a large group from Boston community who wanted to learn more about their government. One day prior to the conference, on January 30th, the headlines in a Texas newspaper said that Congressman Gonzales was demanding a new congressional investigation of the John Kennedy assassination. He said that he had, in quotes, evidence that the CIA and FBI were behind the murder of Kennedy and that Lee Harvey Oswald didn't kill JFK. Those were the headlines of a paper in Texas across the whole front page, January the 30th. Incidentally, at the conference, I presented one of the few new pieces of evidence to come out. The Zapruder films we'll talk about were showed there. Many researchers have the FBI number of Lee Harvey Oswald, and I took to them the documentation taken from microfilm in the National Archives of Lee Harvey Oswald's CIA number, and I'm going to go, hopefully, to Washington in March and present that evidence into the Rockefeller Commission and into the Judiciary Committee, the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald not only worked for the FBI, which was in Gerald Ford's book, the first chapter of his book, The Portrait of the Assassin, but also I will present them with the CIA number of Agent Lee Harvey Oswald. Well, the next same day before the conference that Congressman Gonzales was demanding a new opening, Dick Gregory and Ralph Schoenman and Robert Groton had a press conference in Chicago. And that made the San Francisco Chronicle and the national papers. I saw it in all the papers when I came home. That was January the 30th. And they wanted to know who the three tramps were that are well photographed that were taken away from Dealey Plaza when John Kennedy was killed. They were taken by Dallas police and were never booked as suspects. And they also showed the famous Abraham Zapruder movies of the killing of John Kennedy, which indicated that the fatal shot came from the front. And furthermore, the film shows a gunman on the wall over by the corner of the grassy knoll with his weapon stretched out in front of him. You see his head or ears. The same day that the conference began, Friday the 31st, Dick Gregory and Ralph Schoenman and Robert Groton went to Rockefeller Committee in Washington, D.C., and presented evidence that Oswald was not responsible for this fatal bullet at all, and this should be part of the record of the Rockefeller Commission investigating domestic intelligence. Senator Lowell Weicker and Mr. Baker have seen these movies now. They've been entered into evidence that the Central Intelligence Agency and the FBI were involved, along with some other documentation, in the killing of John Kennedy. Now, those three events set the news for the conference, which was very timely because the Senate was setting up committees to investigate the CIA and the FBI domestically. The House of Representatives is setting up committees for the same subject, as is the Senate Judiciary and also the Blue Ribbon Commission of Vice President Rockefeller. So by Friday evening, Mr. Schoenman had assembled Mr. Groton to the conference, and Dick Gregory came the next day. It was quite a shock to the news media to have all of the various researchers assembled in one place. Not all of them, but a good representation of the most vocal of the researchers were all assembled there. And I think the news media learned as much as the guests, the 1,000 or more guests that attended the conference. The Boston Globe had a front page Monday morning, February the 3rd, called Assassination Workshop: Theories, Rumors, and Wild Guesses. And it begins with this first paragraph. It's by John Wood, Boston Globe staff. Late Saturday night, freelance writer Mae Brussel stood before a sellout audience at Boston University's Morse Auditorium and read rapid fire the names of 30 or 40 people she said were responsible for the assassination of President John Kennedy. We'll go into more of that later, but the coverage did say by yesterday afternoon, speakers, researchers, and private investigators had shown to the satisfaction of many in the audience that, one, Lee Harvey Oswald could not have possibly fired the shot which killed President Kennedy. Two, the Los Angeles Police Department's investigation leaves at least a reasonable doubt as to who killed Robert Kennedy. Three, James Earl Ray and Arthur Bremer, alleged assailants of Reverend Martin Luther King and Alabama Governor George Wallace, may have been employed by one or more government intelligence agencies. Putting these theories together and ignoring vast areas of doubt, some speakers suggested a conspiracy of political and economic interests was responsible for all four shootings and for the demise of the Nixon administration. That's the front page of the Boston Globe, February 3rd, which goes on and has a much longer article about the various researchers, but at least they recognized the media for the first time came out with this kind of coverage. The New York Times on the 3rd of, on Monday, February the 3rd, came out with this article by John Kiffner. Critics of the Warren Report meet to ask a new study. And it said, encouraged by the disclosures of Watergate and of government domestic counterintelligence operations, conspiracy assassination researchers and buffs from across the country gathered here this weekend to ask who killed John F. Kennedy. And it goes on to say that 78% of the American people don't believe the Warren Commission. It goes into the Abraham Zapruder film. Then it says among the most controversial, more controversial of the self-styled researchers was Mae Brussel, who has a syndicated radio show and writes for The Realist magazine, and Sherman Skolnick, who helped force the resignation of three Illinois judges. Speaking in a strident voice, her words tumbling over one another, the California-based Mrs. Brussel described spending 8 years cross-indexing 90 notebooks of everyone who ever met Lee Harvey Oswald, and her conviction that Sirhan Sirhan, convicted of shooting Robert Kennedy, was smuggled into the country by the same CIA network as Marina Oswald under the cover of the Greek Orthodox Church. J. Edgar Hoover was murdered, she snapped in response to a question. He ingested apple pie, and there were Cubans in his house, and I'll stake my reputation on it. The article then goes on to talk about Sherman Skolnick and his work on the plane crash of Dorothy Hunt, and I think it's a very good article. It's the very first time that the newspaper coverage, the major media, have carried this story. Now, of course, the Boston Globe carried it for their own paper. The New York Times carried it for their own paper. The Associated Press, the United Press, as usual, didn't cover the conference the way they should have. But the point is that it could no longer, these people could no longer be ignored by the major media in any way. And the most important thing is they were there and they didn't give it exactly, they had some little snide remarks here, but they didn't give it any more tongue-in-cheek than most of the various researchers were giving each other. Now, what happens when a group of conspiracy researchers get together? What was the purpose of the meeting? What was accomplished? Can we move as a political force until all these facts are open? These questions have to be answered by each of us who attended, and I'm sure each one has a different opinion on the matter. The meeting was sponsored by the Assassination Information Bureau. You can write to them, 63 Inman Street, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02139, if you want information, the program of the meeting, and the various people that were there. The young men that sponsored this is a group of five or six young men who've been going around the country for several years showing the famous Abraham Zapruder movie and lecturing about the John Kennedy assassination. They're full of enthusiasm. They did a fantastic job making the meetings possible, and they hope to spread out their membership and their speaking engagements to reach all people in this country, young or old, and explain away some of the mysteries about the past political assassinations. Now, the thing which these young men do and which made the news so much this last week in all of the papers, this made the Associated Press and United Press, was the Abraham Zapruder film. And I haven't talked about it for a long time. I've had a copy in my own home for 8 or 9 years, and I don't think I've only shown it 2 or 3 times, but even though it was old hat to me, it was new to the news media because they picked it up finally this week, and also the copy of the film is much superior to what I had. And the background of this movie, which is so important, it went to the Rockefeller Committee and the other groups, was that Abraham Zapruder was standing on the same side of the street of the Texas School Depository, where he was standing on the same side of the grass by the curb as the Texas School Depository. And Oswald, according to the Warren Report, was the lone assassin of John Kennedy, and all of his shots came from that school depository window, the sixth floor. That's what the Warren Report said. Oswald's rifle, which was allegedly an Italian Manlico Carcano bolt-action rifle, could only shoot 3 bullets in 5.3 seconds. And by taking the film strip and the timing of the first shot of John Kennedy until the fatal bullet, there were more than 3 shots expended. And you can see John Kennedy's reaction, John Connolly's. One went on the street and hit, it ricocheted from the curb to Mr. Tague's face. It was Mr. Kellerman, the Secret Service agent, who said there was a flurry of bullets that came. The Warren Commission had to limit it to 3. Given Oswald's old rifle and the capability of the rifle, and given the amount of seconds that the firing took place, they had to limit it to 3. And in order to do that, they had to pick up all the other evidence and destroy it, such as the car that John Kennedy drove in was destroyed, the clothing that John Connolly wore was destroyed by dry cleaning, the brain matter of John Kennedy that would show that there were 2 guns by the chemical particles in the brain as compared to Oswald's rifle, the kind of bullets that threw out, that was locked up or destroyed. It was in the archives at one time. The direction of shots was impossible from the sixth floor if they reconstructed the ballistics direction. Only 1 bullet was found when all of this was over, and it was a new bullet with hardly any particles removed. It was supposed to have gone through John Kennedy and John Connolly. The doctors at Parkland Hospital said it was an entry wound into John Kennedy's throat. And the doctors at Bethesda Medical School, the Navy hospital that did the autopsy burned their original autopsy findings. So the discrepancies of the bullets, the direction, is somewhat solved in the famous Abraham Zapruder movie, because it shows very clearly that John Kennedy's head goes backwards, and the law of physics would say that if it was hit from the front, the head would go back. And it also shows a gunman to the far right as it pans, and this was deleted before. And for various years, the researchers have insisted that this Zapruder film was important to solving the Dallas assassination. Computers and Automation published in May 1970, the amount of footage, approximately 25,000 feet of film, that was taken across the street from the Texas School Depository that was never used by the Warren Commission. And those would show a man on the steps at the Dow Texas building, somebody over by the grassy knoll, and it would prove that Oswald was not standing at the sixth floor window where he was supposed to be shooting. So the Warren Commission didn't use any of the films across the street, but they used the one from Mr. Zapruder, and they deleted certain frames. And Life magazine paid Abraham Zapruder $1 million. As soon as John Kennedy was killed, they were right on the street, bought the film, and then the commission never subpoenaed the film to come to their thesis that John Kennedy was killed from the rear, where he's actually killed from the front. And they went around falsifying other evidence of the rifle and pistol and a phony diary that was leaked. And the Warren Commission manipulated all the physical evidence in order to make Oswald the assassin. Now, the Zapruder film was important. It was presented in Washington to the committees investigating domestic intelligence. About the people attending the conference, who actually attended, I can give you a brief rundown. Mark Lane was there. He wrote Rush to Judgment, and he did a movie called Rush to Judgment. Penn Jones, who wrote four books on the Kennedy assassination or deaths relating to the Kennedy assassination called Forgive My Grief, Volume 1, 2, 3, and 4. Wayne Chastain was there, who was writing a book, Who Really Killed Dr. King and the Kennedys, and he's been working with James Earl Ray. Ted Sharrock showed the second gun. That was one of the highlights of this particular event, a real thrill for me because I've been wanting to see that movie for so long, and the story of how it finally got produced or shown is another radio subject of its own. I do want to announce that Ted is going to Chicago, Illinois, to the National Forensic Pathologist Convention, and the various coroners will be there, and he's going to show this movie, The Second Gun, in Chicago in February, and then March the 10th, he'll be in Washington, D.C. with the opening of the movie, The Second Gun, and you will see the man who shot Robert Kennedy, and the evidence is overwhelming against Sirhan being possible to shoot Robert Kennedy. He didn't do it. And this will be shown to various congressmen coming right on top of the Zapruder film of John Kennedy. Ted Sharrock is terribly important because Godfrey Isaacs is reopening the case on Sirhan. And this is a very important movie at this time, but he has a law case opening up just like James Earl Ray has in Memphis, Tennessee, and these two cases are going to trial soon. Bob Cutler helps with the conference getting it together and works with these young men. He's written an entire book on Bullet 399, and he gave a seminar on You, the Jury, regarding Chappaquiddick. Peter Dale Scott was there. He spoke at one discussion group. He wrote a book, The War Conspiracy, and he has an unpublished document, The Dallas Conspiracy. Sherman Skolnick from Chicago was there with Alex Bottos. He has a group called the Citizens Committee to Clean Up the Courts. And you may write to him for literature. I give his address from time to time. It's 9800 South Oglesby Avenue, Chicago, Illinois, 60617. He has literature backing up a lot of what he says in documentation, and for a small donation, you can write to him for this. Incidentally, I'll give the address of the soundtrack for the movie The Second Gun. It's called Why, and it has the campaign speech of Robert Kennedy. It has interviews of newsmen in the Ambassador Hotel. You have Chief of Police Tom Redden, Ramsey Clark, and there's a group of interviews of various newspaper people, newsmen in the Ambassador Hotel, and it's a fantastic record. I'll give you this address if you want to send $5, I believe it is. It's Solar Records, 6277 Selma Avenue, Hollywood, California. It is an excellent record of the soundtrack of Second Gun. If I'm giving these addresses too fast, write to me at KLRB, Carmel, California, and I will copy. Send a self-addressed envelope and tell me what you want, whether it's Mr. Skolnick's address or the Assassination Information Bureau or the Solar Records, and I will send you those addresses. Sherman Skolnick was there with Alex Bottis, and he's done extensive work into the plot to kill John Kennedy in November in Chicago, Illinois, which was stopped. Kennedy didn't show up that weekend because of the murder of Diem in South Vietnam. Carl Oglesby, leader of SDS, who talks about the Yankees and the Cowboys theory as it relates to Watergate or the current power struggle, had a discussion group. This is the struggle of the North versus the South, or the U.S. versus the Rockefeller faction. Jeff Gerth, journalist, investigator, spoke on the area of Miami, Richard Nixon, Rebozo, organized crime, and the links of these men together. Don Fried wrote Executive Action. He helped Louis Tackler with Glass House Tape. He's done a play in Broadway on the Rosenbergs. He's making a movie, Sirhan Sirhan, and Don Fried was there to discuss his various books and plays and as a researcher. And Robert Salant had one seminar group on Saturday on the Wallace shooting. Robert Groden showed his pictures of the Zapruder film, and along with Mark Lane, they discussed the JFK assassination. Tim Butts was in Boston. He represents the Fifth Estate, which is a Washington group to expose intelligence networks inside the USA and their abuse of domestic communities. He publishes The Counter Spy. Their group publishes The Counter Spy. And he also now is branching into the use of political assassinations as a method of utilizing the intelligence system inside the United States. Richard Popkin, a professor of philosophy from St. Louis, author of The Second Oswald, attended the conference. And then Dick Gregory came in on Saturday. He's interested in JFK assassination. And like myself, he's interested in the link of the people who did the assassinations to the present problems of provocateur-type violence and terrorism, to planned famine, to staged riots and police state tactics to eliminate all minorities and genocide. And Dick, like myself, sees the link of the John Kennedy to the genocide that is planned in the future. So he has become very active with the researchers on political assassinations. And then Flo Kennedy was there too, the feminist party, one of the organizers of the feminist party, lawyer, lecturer, and writer, and conference. And she attended the conference. Now, just in analyzing the conference, back to the original question, what happens when a group of researchers get together? Well, Friday evening, Mark Lane spoke about domestic assassinations, and there was a panel discussion of various persons, including myself, on Friday night. Then there were 9 separate conferences going on all day Saturday, and then in Saturday evening, there was a question, who done it? With Mark Lane, Penn Jones, Richard Popkin, Mae Brussel, Sherman Skolnick, and Peter Dale Scott. And Sunday, there was a discussion open to the floor on what do we do about these political assassinations. Can we move as a political force? How do we get organized? Well, some of these people, these researchers, I have known many years, like Mark Lane and Penn Jones, and then through the years I picked up other friends, Ted Chirac, since the Robert Kennedy assassination, Don Fried. We've known each other for many years. I think one of the big problems of getting this information out to the public is that researchers, just like any other group, whether they're insurance salesmen or a convention of shoe salesmen or doctors or whatever it is, you have your thread of politics and ego trips and chopping each other down. And so that each one is interested in selling the, say, 1,000 people plus news media out there their theory more than they were interested in learning from each other what the other one was doing, whether it was a jealousy or an ego trip or a limited ability to understand, I really don't know, but I had the general feeling when all of these heavies got together that they would wine and dine or dance around several people there who had given money to researchers in hopes that something would befall upon them of money, or were interested in the way the news covered it, or influencing, as I say, their particular opinion rather than learning from each other. I have had trouble relating to Mark Lane personally. I've known him since 1964. He spoke at Beverly High in 1964, and he did a lot of work on the grassy knoll. He went right out there, and he did a lot of work on the killing of Kennedy. And I know that when he got into that work in 63, and a lot of men were into the dynamics of the ballistic evidence, I was more interested in the fact that if Oswald didn't shoot John Kennedy, how did the government pass off the fact that Oswald did? How did they fabricate the evidence? What was planted? What was altered? Who was lying? How did they get them to lie? What did they gain from it? So that I spent 11 years finding out who the people were that were involved in covering it up and who were responsible for the assassination. And I saw Mark Lane in 1967 when I went down to see Jim Garrison in New Orleans. And at that time, when I walked in, he walked away. He wasn't interested in what I had done for 4 years, and he was still at the grassy knoll. We met again now in this conference, and again, after 11 years of research, he didn't say, well, what are your conclusions and what is happening? And the last night, the Saturday night, there was a question of who done it. And Penn Jones got up and started to talk about the deaths in the Dallas area. Dick Gregory was talking about different problems, the relationship of fasting to getting your head straight. And Richard Popguy wasn't really naming anybody. He was talking in very vague terms. And Don Free gave a short speech on the dynamics of assassinations and conspiracies. Peter Del Scott went into one corporation down the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and I was getting really very itchy because I just didn't understand how these men could be so wishy-washy after 11 years. They must have certainly thought of something that was going on. I didn't understand how they could be this blocked out. So I got up and said, "J'accuse," and the purpose of this thing is to tell you, well, what happened. It isn't just that Kennedy's head went backward. Who hid the information? Who is not telling you the truth? And those of you that listen to Dialogue Conspiracy know that I am not afraid to mention names. I'm not afraid of lawsuits. I want these things investigated, and I think I have a right to mention names, which I went ahead and did. And I mentioned about 30 people to 40 people that I thought were involved in these particular conspiracies, and I suppose that's why that made the first paragraph of the Boston Globe. I mentioned William Sullivan of Division 5 and Marina Oswald and Captain Fritz of Homicide in Dallas. And I mentioned a list of Michael and Ruth Payne and a cross-section of people that the researchers would not know. And I didn't have time to show how the 40 were involved, Warren Carroll of the CIA with Jack Ruby and various people. But what I told them was that after 11 years, I had names, I knew who was involved, I could sit with any congressional committee or investigative agency and lay down the chain of command, that it is solvable. Now, where the gunmen lived, how they got out of town, where they hid, the channeling of the money, the churches that were cover for the money, where the assassins came from, how they got out of town, they are not theories, they're not just a broad subject of conspiracies in general, these are people, human beings that have names. And Mark Lane hit the ceiling. He got up right away and said, "We're not talking about names. We're not naming names." And the New York Times said that Mr. Lane was visibly upset by these charges that I made. He was visibly upset. And in the closing session, he urged new investigations that were going into this matter should be substantiated. He said, "We should not make statements that most reasonable Americans cannot accept." This is Mark Lane. "We cannot require an acceptance of the unbelievable. It will set us back 20 years. It is their credibility that must be at stake, not ours." Now, this is the same kind of mentality Mark Lane, the researcher, had that the Associated Press and United Press had when I did my article called "Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped?" And I had a press conference in August of 72, and I said Richard Nixon was involved in the Watergate, and Charles Colson was involved, and Colson hired E. Howard Hunt, and John Mitchell was in charge of G. Gordon Liddy, and Robert Marion was involved, and the CIA was involved, and Mullen Associates, and the Young Americans for Freedom, and Douglas Caddy,
And I had a chain of command for the news media, and my reputation as a researcher was at stake as much as theirs, and I felt that my credibility would hang or sink. It would just be dependent upon the reliability of my research to say that the CIA was involved in the Watergate, and later the evidence of their providing cameras and developing film and safe houses and aliases and more to come later, you'll see, was in fact true. And I feel that these men, for the most part, they were very weak. I got a lot of applause from the women. I was the only woman there, the only woman researcher, and the only woman on the panel in the evenings speaking up. And the Boston University people were fantastic. The ones that listened to the radio show, introduced themselves, came up. They were thinking about the way I threw out my information. And they were very, they were applauding, and they were enthusiastic, and they were behind me. And if the news media had been there and nobody had presented one name of who was guilty in these conspiracies, they'd say, well, after 11 years, they haven't come up with any answers. So I took a position which horrified Mark Lane by naming approximately 40 people out of maybe 200 that I have. But to just throw out names that they do have names, Mr. Bloomfield in Montreal and Permadex Corporation and the funding and the chain of command and Albert Osborne, alias John Howard Bowen, and I gave these names because I don't think that a conference like that should go away any more than a conference on Watergate and not name who was involved. I was very surprised at other people, such as Richard Popkind. He knew that there was a second Oswald. He wrote a book about it. There was a document called the Torbett Document, which various researchers have, that talks about Don Norton, who was a double for Lee Oswald, who took money from David Ferry in Montreal, Canada, again where the funding came from, down to Mexico at the time that E. Howard Hunt was down there. And Don Norton was a double for Oswald. And I met Don Norton last November when I was speaking at a college in the Midwest. Some people can tell you about him. He's a dead ringer for Oswald, and he rattled off a record that Oswald had made in New Orleans, so I would recognize his voice. And I'm in contact with him regularly so that when this story breaks open, I think that he will produce himself and back up what I'm saying. But Popkind wrote a book in 66 called The Second Oswald, and he knew that I was in touch with this man, and yet he turned away. I don't know whether it was professional jealousy or what, but he didn't want to know about this Oswald that is living very close to where he's living and teaching right now at the present time. Then Wayne Chastain was there, who's doing the book on Martin Luther King and the two Kennedy killings, and he had a study group, and he gave his presentation, and when they asked him questions, he was unfamiliar with the CIA links to James Earl Ray, but the worst part was that he didn't really want to know, and when I told him things, he kind of smiled and looked the other way, and I wonder how much of the true story is going to come out if these researchers themselves have a block receiving information. Maybe they're only there to tell part of the story, or maybe they're professionally jealous and don't want you to tell them anything. But Mr. Chastain was not familiar with the fact that James Earl Ray had a identification the day before he left the prison, a Social Security card that was given to him by his brother the day before, or that Ray stayed at a CIA safe house in Illinois, or at a trailer that was ready for him, or that when he left the penitentiary in Missouri that a warden didn't call an alert that anyone was missing for 24 hours, and then the warden at the penitentiary there was allegedly a lawyer that worked with the anti-Castro Cubans from the Bay of Pigs. He wasn't aware, or said he wasn't aware, that Virgilio Gonzalez, the locksmith at the Watergate Hotel, had an alias of R-A-O-U-L, and that James Earl Ray was meeting in New Orleans on the same street, the same location that Lee Harvey Oswald was meeting with a man named R-A-O-U-L, Raoul. And Wayne Chastain talked about Raoul, but he didn't ask James Ray if it was Gonzalez. I asked him if he asked him that, and he hadn't asked that question. And he apologized that Ray's alias could have come from his brother, who had underworld connections. And I said, did you rule out that the same CIA that fitted out all the Watergate people, Hunt, Barker, Liddy, McCord, could have made the same ID for James Earl Ray, and he couldn't rule that out. In other words, the links of the Dallas Watergate thing are very closely tied into the John Kennedy, Martin Luther King murders, too. But I was very surprised that Mr. Chastain was writing a book, and his articles have been reprinted in Computers and People, but he has a safe boundary, again, of not trying to link the highest echelons of government, but keeping it at a low-level plot. Now, Ted Chiarock did show the movie The Second Gun. He was ignored by the well-known researchers like Mark Lane and, well, I think Penn Jones and Bob Cutler and all of them. I think there was a little elite. Maybe I'm wrong. They seemed to be a little bit of elitism. They didn't ask Ted Chiarock to sit up on the stand on Friday night or on Saturday night to the large groups. He showed his movie. It was scheduled for once, and I didn't, one session, and I wouldn't give my group if I couldn't see his movie. They were coming at the same time, and I insisted and begged that they do it again, so he showed it on Sunday afternoon to a full audience and answered questions. He had no chance to speak. He had no forum. He was in the Ambassador Hotel just inches away from Robert Kennedy when he was shot. He's followed the thing from that hour, and Ted Chiarock was ignored by Don Fried, who's doing the movie Sirhan, Sirhan. Jack Kimbrough came all the way from California and did the first book on the Robert Kennedy assassination, and he was sort of put aside. There's a certain clique that move around, that try to get money and try to get the press coverage and do a pretty good job, but they don't go any further than a certain area, and they put down anybody else who's doing the work, and I think that's very unfortunate. I also mentioned on the floor on Sunday, one young kid got up and said, well, I think we should worry about assassinations in the future, but we'll never find out who killed John Kennedy. And I told them about a very reputable and well-known lawyer in Beverly Hills. I told the whole group this one afternoon, where there's almost 1,000 sitting in a hall before we left on Sunday. And I told them that there's a lawyer in Los Angeles who has called me, and that he has a friend working in aerospace on Santa Monica Boulevard in California who has in a vault all the information that is also in a vault overseas about the killing of John Kennedy, and that one of the gunmen lives in Canada and through an intermediary wanted to meet me. As soon as I can get some money and time to go to Canada, I would meet this gunman, that he is willing to talk. I think he knows the same as David Ferry or Clay Shaw or Jack Ruby. He will be murdered if the investigations go too far, so he wants to surface now like a John Dean and tell what he knows. And I gave this information as well as the CIA number of Lee Harvey Oswald that links him not only to the FBI but to the Central Intelligence Agency. And I can truthfully say there wasn't one researcher that came up to me afterwards and wanted to know about the man in Canada. Now, from the floor, somebody came to me right away. They live in Canada and wanted to know what city. And somebody from Argosy magazine asked me how it was they came to me and approached me, and I gave the story for the magazine, but there wasn't one serious researcher who's worked 11 years or 6 years or 5 years or two very hard that was interested in really knowing if that gunman did in fact exist. And based upon my extensive research and my reputation for having facts pretty clear and not throwing out wild theories, it was pitiful that, and even the young men from the Assassination Information Bureau who are sitting on the stand, not one of them came up and said, look, let's get you to where the man is and find out if he was the gunman. This may solve all of our problems. Not one person in the mind of the researchers, and that is pitiful. I don't mean to put them down, and it isn't really sour grapes, because I will continue to publish, do radio shows. This show goes all over the country. It goes to Sweden. I'm doing radio shows from the home. Yesterday it was Wichita, Kansas. Tomorrow it'll be Milwaukee, all different states. I'm reaching a lot of people, and it's pitiful that the researchers themselves didn't have a workshop where they listened to each other, say, for 2 days, and then talked to the people at large about their own individual accomplishments. I think the researchers should clue each other in so that when they're asked questions about Martin Luther King, they also know about Chappaquiddick. If they're asked about John Kennedy, they know about Robert Kennedy. I think they should get off their individual ego trips and not keep pushing their own thing and learn what the other people have to say too. At least consider it as a long series of assassinations and conspiracies that are possibly linked, and they should go over each other's material for names, like Second Oswald's. Popkin did the book on Second Oswald. He could collect the information, which I have, on to Donald DeFries, to Sirhan Sirhans, to three James Rays. He could assimilate that if that's his specialty, you see. And I think they should get together. I was talking about the Eustachian violence as related to conspiracies, and Sherman Skolnick is working into the American Odessa file in Chicago, which fits my research, and we work very well that way. But by and large, the men were on their separate trips, and altogether they weren't too thrilled with a woman there, but I stayed there and gave out some facts, and hopefully they'll be used. But it was a good conference, and the media took notice, and we will have other conferences, and in the future I'll tell you a little more about them. That's all for this week. Dialogue Conspiracy, it moves pretty fast. I'll see you next week. Take care, and we'll be back with you next week.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 10 years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KELRB-FM in Carmel, California.